morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, now in depth on what they'll say and what they'll mean. While the presidential candidates are doing the high road stuff, the town halls, the policy speeches, the one-on-one meetups with voters, their ads will be doing some of the dirty work, often saying things the candidates never would face-to-face, although that might be debatable this time around with Donald Trump. The Super PAC commercials can be even tougher. Here's a commercial that a Super PAC supporting Hillary Clinton is running against Donald Trump.
When I saw Donald Trump mock a disabled person, I was just shocked.
You got to see this guy. Oh, I don't know what I said. I don't remember.
That reporter he is talking about suffers from a chronic condition that impairs.
In all, the candidates for president and their supporters and surrogates will raise and spend close to $10 billion. A big chunk of it will go to television advertising. So we've asked longtime journalism scholar Kathleen Hall Jamieson and New York Times journalist Nick Khorasani to help inform and prepare us for the onslaught. And as they join us, I want you to think about this. You might already know which candidate you're supporting in November. How comfortable are you with the negative commercials that candidate will run against his or her opponent? Is it fair game? Does it make you cringe? Why and why not? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. We're having a discussion at nprnews.org/live. I'm on Twitter. Just tweeted out a question about this. It's at Carrie NPR. Kathleen Hall Jamieson is a director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. She joins us today from Bloomington, Indiana. Kathleen, you're in Bloomington. Welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Actually, I'm in Bloomington, Minnesota.
What? Oh, you're in Minnesota. I thought you were in
Indiana. I am. I'm just down the street from you.
Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank
Wish you,
you
were in the studio, but okay, you got stuff to do today. And Nick Khorasani is with us. He's a reporter for the New York Times, where he writes about politics and media. Nick, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Kathleen, we got some interesting political news over the last couple of days, and that's where the candidates sit with the money that they have in the bank. Hillary Clinton, 40-plus million in the bank. Donald Trump, 1.2. Even if he wanted to make a big media buy, he couldn't. But I'm going to ask you if it really matters, given the way he's campaigning.
What matters is the amount of access your message has to the audience that is likely to vote and also to vote for you. If Trump can continue to gain free media access and also reach that target constituency, he can counterbalance some of the effects of being outspent. But the second thing that money does, which is not translated to advertising, which is important, is it lets you create the organizational structures that put volunteers in districts to reach households person to person. And that mobilizing effect also requires resources. And that may be where he has the biggest disadvantage, not in media access, but in participation on the ground, human contact.
Yeah, Nick, Trump, as you know, has been saying, I don't really need the campaign ads because whenever I speak, the media rushes up to hear what I'm saying. Do you think Kathleen's right? It's the money deficit is about the organization, not really about getting his message out.
Yeah, I think that's certainly correct, although I think that there's a few things that ads can do that are kind of unique when you put the money behind them. Like, as he's getting hammered by Secretary Clinton and the Super PAC supporting her, he can go and rebut the message directly with paid media. So he can be a little more targeted in the exact thing he wants to say in a 30-second or 60-second soundbite. And he can also, you know, do a lot more on digital that he hasn't done yet with more money. If Senator Bernie Sanders' campaign showed us anything, it's that you can really have a powerful grassroots-driven campaign, which is a lot of what Mr. Trump's campaign has been powered by, when you put a decent amount of money behind your digital advertising, your digital messaging.
Yes. Tell me, Nick, what he would be doing on digital that would get the message out in a way that matters more than, you know, the way he's campaigning now, again, with the speeches and all the interviews and the attention that he gets.
Well, he certainly gets a lot on cable, but and he's got a great organic following on social media. His Twitter account, you know, can start a news cycle anytime, and he jokes about that on the campaign trail all the time. Like, I tweet one thing, and then in comes CNN with a breaking news alert. And he's certainly not wrong there, and on Facebook, he's got a great organic reach, too. But that's just been for, like, you know, getting his message out, the kind of things that riles up his base. Now, what he could be doing more of, and we just saw, I think, yesterday the first time, that he could be doing these paid ads on Facebook, click to donate, which could build up a small dollar donor base and start to have people coming back more to the campaign site, giving money more regularly. He could be doing it to organize volunteers in states. You know, going back to the way that Senator Sanders did it, he had all of his volunteers organized online, either in like, you know, volunteer-driven Slack groups or on their events page on their website. And Trump's campaign doesn't have that yet. So once they start building out a little bit more infrastructure and maybe targeting a little bit more of their ads on Facebook, he doesn't really need to do on Twitter, but certainly on Facebook and some videos on Facebook that could you know, be spread to people who he might not be reaching yet, who aren't in his organic audience. That would help him get more support.
I was just going to say, Kathleen, Nick has raised a question for me, which is where we're at on the influence of digital advertising versus traditional television advertising. Do you have a sense of that?
We're switching over. And what digital advertising permits you to do, and micro-targeted cable and micro-targeted radio, is reach people who are not in the mass media stream and hence don't see the speeches, don't hear the cable, and also are not his followers. What micro-targeting lets you do is identify the voter who is not likely to vote, but if the person votes, will vote for you, and translate that person from a person who has a low likelihood to vote to a person who votes. That's how you win elections. George W. Bush in 2004, through a micro-targeting operation, very carefully orchestrated in Ohio, backed by volunteers who moved into those areas in which the micro-targeted voters were, managed to increase the likelihood that he'd have high turnout in Ohio. That's the reason he won that election.
I want to make sure that I understand what you just said, though. You said these voters, often that you're reaching on digital sources, are not necessarily going to vote. But just in case they do vote, they're going to vote for you.
You can motivate the voter who is a low likelihood voter to vote by contacting the person, by giving the person an absentee ballot,
okay,
by increasing the likelihood that they know when they're supposed to ballot, by getting them to commit to vote. All those things increase the likelihood that someone who will vote for you if they vote will actually cast the vote. What political scientists call that is converting a low propensity voter into a high propensity voter by some form of voter contact. And doing that requires money. The vehicle is micro-targeting, both through tailored advertising, not mass-mediated advertising, and through personal contact.
So, Nick, is there a sense now that's the route that Trump is headed when, again, as you say, he gets so much earned media, maybe he doesn't have to worry about TV so much?
It might be a bit early to say that we're getting the sense that he's going to do that, as we've seen his campaign can be a little bit unpredictable and untraditional. He has started as of yesterday, because I was personally like served a promoted ad from his campaign to donate, and it had the same kind of language and style that you know, Trump does on social media on his own personal accounts.
Oh.
So there are signs that he might switch to it, but we haven't really seen, and throughout the primary, he didn't really feel like he had a need to, you know, kind of really dive into this digital advertising, or really advertising in general. He was not a big spender or believer in either digital or broadcast ads, because I think he thought he could get his message out, and he thought his crowd size at the rallies was also an indicator of the groundswell support he had.
Which you have to beware of, right? I mean, what the crowds are like that show up at your rallies aren't always indicative of your widespread support.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, as you could see, and you could pick a state, either going to Sanders or one that Trump lost, they were still bringing in thousands and thousands of people, and then they still lost by a lot.
Yeah, you know, this digital thing is something I want to take to our listeners as well. So if you've just tuned into the conversation, we're talking about the kind of campaign advertising that's going to go on and has been going on this year in our presidential election. We started out a bit, and I was thinking we were going to end up talking primarily about television advertising, but that leaves out a big part of the equation here. We should also be talking about digital ads. So I want to hear from you whether the negative ads, the traditional negative ads that you see on television, are something that you just kind of factor in, even if it's done by the candidate that you're supporting. You figure that's part of the political game, or they kind of make you cringe. You're uncomfortable with that. And I want to know about digital advertising. Is it effective to you when an ad for a candidate pops up when you're on Facebook or on some other social media source? Is that something that makes you stop and think, that might even motivate you to vote for that candidate? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter, at Carrie NPR, where Blake says, well, it's part of politics. Wish it didn't have to be this way. Policy over personal attacks is preferable. Jay says, current state of politics is already a raging garbage fire. Negative ads won't offend me more than anything else. And to Mike in Sartell. Hey, Mike. Hi. How are you thinking about this?
Hi. How are you doing? Basically, my comment is I'm already committed. I've been a four-time delegate to my party's state convention. The ads aren't going to affect me. But here's the problem I have. And as a active participant and somebody that pays attention, a lot of what is said, and I know there's political action committees that sponsor a lot of this stuff, but a lot of the accusations are baseless. And in a lot of situations, they're just flat out lies. And I would like to know why there isn't any sort of accountability or retribution. And, you know, the fact that they get away with that, I know that negative ads are effective because that's why campaigns use them. They've been proven to be effective.
Yeah, right.
That being said, I think it's so wrong, and I think it pollutes the system even further. And I think you can take it from there.
Okay, so you're talking about accountability. And Kathleen, there is some accountability, right, with the fact-checking that goes on, your organization and others.
Yes, I mean, factcheck.org, along with PolitiFact and the Washington Post Fact Checker, will routinely check any claim that is found in a candidate ad or in a candidate debate. But here's the problem. There's an advantage in having it there, and it's useful. And when all three groups go after the same thing, as do other media, particularly media that you as a consumer read, you increase the likelihood that that message will get through. You don't necessarily increase the likelihood that the candidate will, as a result, correct. If the candidate believes that the candidate has the ability to speak in a voice that's loud enough to overcome it, has enough access to overcome the fact-checking, what we hear most often is what we're most likely to accept, particularly if it's consistent with what we ideologically agree with to begin with. And the other problem with the fact-checking is the people most likely to get the fact-checking information are not the ones most susceptible to the deceptions in the advertising and in the campaign speeches. So we have a disconnect between the audience for fact-checking and the audience for those messages.
Boy, Nick, I find that pretty discouraging. Do you, as a journalist?
I mean, we do our best to fact-check every story, but Kathleen's absolutely right. And this is something I've always struggled with, trying to think of a better way to get what we write when we fact-check in front of the people who might be watching the ads, you know, whether we could, like, create a Shazam app for political ad fact-checking or something like that. But there is a risk that can happen when you do a negative ad, that sometimes it either goes too far, or if, you know, the claim is found to be such a lie that it ends up driving a news cycle, then it could actually have, like, a negative impact on the candidate. So there is, I don't want to say there's, like, real accountability, but there is sometimes a risk that a negative ad can backfire if it goes too far, misreads the electorate, or perhaps the lie can just be so egregious that, you know, that becomes the story of the ad, not the actual message.
Yeah, Sean kind of backs you up here on Twitter. He says, negative ads make me have a negative view of the group or person sponsoring them. So this brings me to super PACs and the role that they end up playing. I mean, let's talk about Priorities USA, which is a super PAC that supports Hillary Clinton that's running that ad that we played in the introduction. $9 million so far that they've spent on negative ads against Trump. There is not supposed to be any coordination between the campaign and the super PACs. But Nick, I mean, that just seems like a very thin veil that the super PACs kind of hide behind. Am I being too cynical about that?
No, you're absolutely right. There's you saw this actually a lot with Carly Fiorina's campaign.
Yeah.
Anything that's done in public by either a super PAC or a candidate, so that means whether they put it on their website, whether they put it out on social media, is not considered coordinating. It's just something in the public that anyone can read. So, for example, Carly's campaign would put their schedule on a Google map, and then the super PAC would know exactly where to go and set up advance and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, anything Hillary says in her speeches or what she puts on her website or on her Twitter is a message, to her supporters, but it could also be a message to Priorities, like, this is something that we're looking at. And when Priorities releases its ads on YouTube, you know, days before they're about to go up on air, that's also so the campaign can see, oh, here's the finished product. You know,
wow.
Maybe if there's a problem, we can disavow the ad on social or something like that.
Wow. So really they're sending signals if there aren't phone calls going back and forth between the campaign and the super PAC, which there are not to be, mm-hmm. there's plenty of ways to send signals about the direction they're heading. And hey, campaign, you liking this?
Exactly. I mean, that's not to say that that's the only reason they're doing it, and that by putting an ad on Facebook, it's just a message to the super PAC. I mean, they also want to get it out for earned media and to supporters and everything like that. But at the same time, it's not like either is operating in this vacuum where they don't exactly know what the other one is doing.
Yeah. Kathleen, what do you do about that? And is that a deal that you have to do something about, in your view?
Oh, it's inevitable. So I don't think there's anything you can do about it. They also have common polling data. So, you know, everybody asks the same basic sets of questions in polls. They identify the weaknesses on the other side. That, coupled with the fact that there is public telegraphing, means that for practical purposes, the messages are coordinated, even if there wasn't coordinating in private in order to create them. But let me step back to something else. I'm afraid we're sounding too pessimistic about how the process works.
Okay.
When ads are effective and they caricature someone, so the ads have now reshaped a view and it's not consistent with who the person actually is, the debates are somewhat of a corrective. And so when the mass public comes to see debates, often the person who has been caricatured in the ads, false image created of the individual, benefits in the debates because the person who appears on the debate stage doesn't resemble the caricature at all. And so we do have debates. Debates are informative. And importantly, candidates are far less likely to engage in deception in debates than they are in their advertising or that their super PACs are in the advertising on their behalf.
But the trouble with that, Kathleen, is if Priorities USA puts out an ad in June that says Donald Trump doesn't like people with disabilities, we're not going to have the first debate until sometime in September. The impression has been kind of cemented against him, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's true. But the research that we have from the 2004 campaign, in which the Bush campaign had very effectively created a caricature of John Kerry, suggests that the debate performance of Kerry counteracted a good part of the caricature created by the ads. And so the question is, you know, to what extent does the debate image counteract the image that is the image created in the ads? And in some cases, it's not able to do it. But at least there's that capacity there. And we know that people watch debates in large numbers. We'd like them to be larger, but in large numbers. And that in the debates, you have a recalibration that is possible. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to change your vote, but at least there's a possibility to recalibrate your assessment.
Nick, what would you say about that?
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. And I think that that's also while you sometimes see like the rebuttal ads. But I do think there is something to be said about what Priorities is trying to do to Trump right now. And that's if you look at what the Obama campaign did to Mitt Romney in 2012, they bought a bunch of advertising almost as soon as the general started and ran a ton of ads hitting him on his record while he was in charge of Bain. And it tried to just depict him as this out-of-touch millionaire that he, you know, kind of struggled to fix.
Right.
And I think they called it defining early and often. And that's almost the exact playbook that you're seeing Priorities USA try to do, and the Clinton campaign now, too, since they've gone on the air.
Of course, Trump gives them a lot of ammunition to work with there for the Priorities USA and the Clinton campaign, doesn't he?
Well, the extended primary is actually what's giving them the most ammunition. Like, you know, when Priorities first went on the air, Guy Cecil did a bunch of interviews, and he said, you know, we went through the Never Trump movement ads, and we tested all of them, and they focus grouped everything from eminent domain ads from the Cruz campaign to the mocking reporter with disability that the Right to Rise did, and they found what was, you know, most effective. So their work was already halfway done for them by these Republican candidates and super PACs that were trying to stop Trump in the primary. And then when they tested them with the general election audience or with the audiences they were hoping to reach, like independent women and millennial voters, they realized what worked best, and they could just kind of recreate a message off those ads.
Hmm. Nick Korasanides with us. He's a reporter for The New York Times, writes about politics and media and campaigns. And Kathleen Hall Jamison is director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. She'll be at the Westminster Town Hall Forum on Thursday. And I'd like, as you're listening into this conversation, I'd like to hear from you about how you're affected by the kinds of campaign ads that the campaigns and the super PACs are running. I want you to think about this. You might already know which candidate you're supporting in November. How comfortable are you with the kind of negative commercials that the candidates and the super PACs that support those candidates are running? Is it fair game? Talk to me about the impact of digital campaign advertising to you, too. Does it mean anything to you when you're working on Facebook, hanging out there, and some of these political ads pop up? Do you think they're effective? Maybe they're more effective than you think they are. 800-242-2828, 651-227-6000 to Ted in Fulda. Is this the former representative? Ted, hi.
Yes.
Hi,
yes.
Good to have you on the line.
Yes, I'm very disheartened with the kind of name-calling that has been going on between the presidential candidates, you know, in the last few months. I mean, we try to teach our grandchildren and our children to be respectful to each other, and we have the two main leaders who want to be the people that we should all look up to, acting like a bunch of fifth graders on the schoolyard. And how do we, as a society of people, get back to having some decency and respect to each other when we have our candidates, you know, acting this way? I think it's, you know, I've been through negative ads. I've had the impact on the families, you know, that have to take it all the time, you know, in the chin, you know, from every negative ad. A lot of them are half truthful, but I think the main issue that we got going on now with Trump and with the assault, you know, and it was on a major news media this morning, you know, they said there was an assault by each other on each other. Well, I mean, are we getting down to the point where we're assaulting each other as a way to win elections? I think that's very disheartening, and I think it's going to be hard for us to, as a society, to get back to where we can be respectful and decent to each other. So
Nick,
that's my comment.
Yeah, thank you for calling, Ted. Nick, you're hearing this from a former state legislator who ran his share of campaigns. I know we have to let you go in a minute, but I'd love to hear from you on this.
I think one thing that is kind of fueling this is the constant media attention around this election, and what makes for like a better news hook on TV or maybe in a print story is when the candidates go at each other. It's dramatic. It's, you know, sometimes even Shakespearean. So those negative ads get more earned media, and then that encourages campaigns to keep doing that. And I think it's like some kind of a vicious cycle in that sense, that the more negative you go, the more attention you'll get. But at the same time, I do think that there is like that tipping point that we were talking about earlier when you can go too negative and you can turn voters off. And I think if these campaigns, especially because this campaign has been so long, if this starts out negative as it has and continues that way, you might see a course correction down the line where people are going to be looking for a little bit more of those ads that, say, Secretary Clinton ran at the end, focusing on loving kindness or families.
Yeah. You know, Nick, I know you're going to be covering, you're one of the Times reporters who's going to be watching this Trump speech today, right?
Mm-hmm.
Shortly, in which he is, we've already been hearing in news headlines this morning, it's going to be very negative. He's really going after Hillary Clinton. You must feel a little ambivalent about today and how it's going to be covered, given what you just said.
Well, I mean, this is what the candidate is going to say, and we're going to cover his, you know, see what he's trying to do with his message. He's obviously trying to also distract a little bit from the bad news week he's had.
Yeah.
You know, his fundraising numbers were kind of historically bad. He had a lot of bad headlines, like firing your campaign manager. So coming up and going negative is going to do that same kind of you know, media narrative shift that he's kind of looking for. But I think we're all also aware of that. And, you know, you'll see that at least from our organization's point of view.
Is there going to be fact-checking on the Times on some of the stuff he's going to say?
Yeah. We always try and do that both in, you know, in articles. Like, I'll always put, whenever I'm covering Trump at rallies, I'll do parenthetical fact-checks where I can. Like, he constantly always says Hillary Clinton wants to abolish the Second Amendment.
Yeah, he does.
And that's not
right.
True. So we'll either say falsely accused or put a parenthetical in there, the same way we would when, you know, Secretary Clinton would make a false claim about Trump. But this speech, since we know it will be, you know, about certain, like her record, which has been well trod over through campaigns and an extended 2016 campaign, we'll certainly be ready to fact check what he says.
Nick, thank you. Please come back. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Kathleen, to what we were just talking about with Nick, with the way this speech that Trump's giving today has been framed and then the kind of coverage that will follow it, some thoughts, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, right now, MSNBC is putting up on its tag on the bottom of the screen, Trump readies full frontal assault on Clinton.
Yeah.
I worry about the metaphors of war and of violence that we use to characterize political speech. The framing that we offer
increases the likelihood that that is what candidates expect that they're supposed to do and audiences expect them to do. But if we could step back to the civility issue for a moment, I think we've got a real obligation to police our own ideological side. We've done studies of perceived civility across time, particularly in cable news. And what we saw was that those left-leaning groups would point out instances of incivility on the right, and the right-leaning media outlets would point it out on the left, but they wouldn't point it out on their own side. And sometimes they're condemning the same something that their own side does as well. So, for example, when rallies showed Hitler signs analogizing to Obama, you know, the side that was most likely to feature that were the left-leaning media. When those same kinds of signs were used against Scott Walker, it was those who were on the right that were focusing on the fact that they were there. But when they saw the signs on their own side, they weren't featuring it. And as a result, if you watched the media on the right, you'd think the problem was on the left. And if you watched the media on the left, you'd think the problem was on the right, when there was actually a problem in both places, and both were overrepresenting its prevalence. And so we were increasing the public perception that it was normal in those contexts when it was abnormal. The media have some responsibility here to make sure that when they see incivility, they call it out regardless of where it is.
You just mentioned the MSNBC headlines. I've got CNN on in the studio, and it says, in minutes, breaking news, Trump unleashes Clinton attack speech. The other thing that kind of concerns me about the way the media covers this is, is that, you know, do the campaigns believe that's the kind of thing you have to do to get the wall-to-wall coverage from the media until we get to the debate time, which, again, is still at least 60-some days away?
One of the things that we know historically is that the media coverage overrepresents the amount of attack that does exist in discourse. And so if you content analyze, now that we have not done this yet for this year, and this year may turn out to be the exception, but up until this year, if you content analyze the total speech of each of the major candidates and then look at the press coverage, you will see far more proportional coverage of the attack in the speech than of any of the advocacy.
Wow, because the media likes conflict.
It's more negative than it was.
Yeah, the media likes conflict, but you're right. It leaves the absolutely wrong impression.
And it means it's less likely that we know what the candidates stand for.
Right.
And less likely, you know, we're less likely to know what they stand for, more likely to know what they stand against. That's not a good way to anchor a vote. It's better to vote for something because that tells you that you know the relationship between the campaigning and governance. If you just vote against something, the candidate you opposed isn't elected, you don't know what the candidate you favored is going to do when the person governs.
Adrian says on this question of digital advertising, the effect of ads on millennials might be overestimated. Google Adblock and Netflix HBO Go instead of television means I never, ever see them. To Joe in Sioux City, Iowa. Hey, Joe, on this issue of digital advertising.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Say, I think a lot of the problem is in the titling of ads on the print and in the digital side. And then when you get down into the body of it, try to find what they're talking about, it just leaves you flat because it doesn't really mean what they're trying to display on the title of the news article.
Yeah, Joe, so I understand what you're saying. You mean like the headline of the ad is misleading when you get into the ad to look at the details,
right,
of it?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. And pop-up ads, I hate them things. And if they come up, I'll probably vote against anybody using that kind of garbage.
They're all using it, though, aren't they?
Well, that may be true, especially if the information is misleading and it's not according to reality. As an independent, I watch and listen to words being used. Candidates, if they're talking about something that a candidate said, I'll go out and find the actual clip. And I would say most of the time what the media is trying to make out to be something and what the reality of the clip is totally different. The credibility of the media is, in my estimation, it's about 20%.
Kathleen, Joe, thanks for the call. Kathleen, what do you hear there besides a pretty frustrated voter?
Well, I hear two things. First, in the earlier comment, yes, ad blocking is a powerful means of minimizing the power of advertising over a group, and to the extent that the young are more technologically savvy, they're increasing the likelihood they've minimized the effects of pernicious ads. Good for them, and we ought to do more of it. The Independent Voter and the Moderate Voter act in a very different way from the high partisan voter. And to the extent that a campaign is trying to win the independents and win the moderates, it tends to moderate. It tends to be more civil. But to the extent that it's trying to mobilize a base and create an election in which it wins because more of its kind turn out, you tend to get more extreme and less civil discourse. And so those independents and those moderates out there, to the extent that they're important in the electoral equation, do have a very positive impact on the system. They create a tendency toward higher civility.
I always learn so much, Kathleen, when you're on the show. I'm glad you can do this. Steph, off the page.
Sean says, there's a huge problem that I face on social media. As a college student, a majority of my new friends support Bernie Sanders still and are heavily negative towards both Hillary and Trump. News feeds are filled with negative advertisements posted and shared by friends and then liked by friends. Being able to see this negative ad backed by friends creates peer pressure. There's more of a pressure to conform or remain quiet.
Peer pressure, Kathleen. What would you say the effect is of that?
Now, the fact that we exist within a like-minded universe in which we tweet and we follow those who are more likely to agree with us than those who disagree, we tend to increase what we call enclaving, a world in which everything reinforces what we believe, and that tends to move toward more extreme discourse. There's been a lot of very ugly social media discourse on both sides right now, and it, to the extent that it has personalized an opponent and not featured the philosophical differences, but instead attacked the integrity of that person, called that person names, we are not in a world in which people are able to step back into a system in which their candidate loses and say, all right, now, is the candidate whom I opposed in the primary still a candidate whom I can support? The risk is people will disengage and not vote at all, or they will cast a vote they might not otherwise have cast for someone of an opposite ideology.
Kathleen Hall Jamieson continues with us this morning. If you've just joined the discussion, we're talking about the kind of campaign advertising that we're seeing in this presidential election season. I should also ask about how the down ballot races may be affected by this. So I'll make a note to do that. I also want to talk to Kathleen about there's a bill in Congress called the Empower Act. It's in the Senate. It would increase the tax return checkoff and might introduce the idea of how things would be different if we had public financing of campaigns. I know Congress would actually have to agree to this, and maybe their interest is not in doing that. But I do want to hear from Kathleen on that, and I want to hear from you on the effect of the television advertising, the digital advertising that you see. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 on Twitter. And back on the other side of news. And Phil, you're watching campaign news, I'll bet, this hour.
Yes, Carrie. Donald Trump hopes his speech today helps rally Republicans to his campaign. Trump plans to focus on Hillary Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State. He will argue her foreign policy is in part responsible for the creation of the Islamic State militant group. Clinton today lays out economic goals in a speech in North Carolina. She says she will make sure Wall Street and the wealthy pay their fair share in taxes, and she will tackle the twin problems of college affordability and student debt. The International Monetary Fund is downgrading its forecast for the U.S. economy this year, and it says America should raise the minimum wage to help the poor and offer paid maternity leave to encourage more women to work. In its annual checkup of the U.S. economy, the IMF predicts 2.2% growth this year, down from 2.4% in 2015. A group that wants Britons to vote tomorrow to stay in the European Union had hoped to hand French pastries today to London commuters as an act of friendship, but Britain's Electoral Commission says that would violate guidelines banning the use of food to influence votes. Instead, commuters at two London subway stations were given postcards from Parisians asking them to stay. 600 croissants from Paris were donated to homeless shelters. A parade that has been held somewhere else for more than 50 years is rolling through Cleveland today, no longer the butt of jokes. It is a title town again. Hundreds of thousands of fans Some arriving last night to camp out on the sidewalk or lining the downtown streets to cheer the Cleveland Cavaliers basketball team. They won the NBA championship, overcoming a two-game deficit in the best-of-seven series against Golden State. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:41.
Later on All Things Considered, chef and restaurateur Thomas Kim says authenticity isn't the best standard for food.
People's idea of authenticity tends to be a really, really subjective opinion.
I'm Tom Cran. Appetites plus all the day's news. Join me starting at 3.
Hey, if you're headed to the lake this weekend or for the long holiday weekend next weekend, I want to put a book in your summer beach bag, all right? You can find a great list from our Take It to the Lake summer fiction series. Check it out on the thread. And by the way, next Friday, we announce the new season of Talking Volumes. I am so excited for this to start. I don't want to wish away summer, but I can't wait to get started on the new season. You'll see the list next Friday. Tickets available for members then.
Support comes from the 6 Minnesota Initiative Foundation, celebrating 30 years of supporting Greater Minnesota by dispersing $430 million in grants and loans, offering leadership, programming, and services to rural communities. Information at greaterminnesota.net.
Back to our conversation now on campaign advertising. To the phones to Pat in Deep Haven. Pat, hey, thank you for waiting. What are you thinking about?
You know, I have started to really be disillusioned with news programs because they all seem to have some kind of catchphrase. Even with tragedies, as if they're titling a TV program or a book, you know, Tragedy in Orlando, or, you know, and it seems like that's what politicians do too. It's like, let's get some catchphrase that's going to spur interest, and I don't know. I just don't know what's just happened to plain advertising. Give us the facts. Tell us what's going on. Quit trying to pretend that, you know, this isn't real life. It's
yeah.
not fiction.
Yeah, Pat, Kathleen, some of this is trying to break through just the noise, right?
Yes, but in the process, it draws down the capacity of language to actually do what it wants to do. I mean, when years ago, if someone put breaking news on the screen, the nation would stop.
Right.
Because it meant you had had the shuttle explode or you'd had an assassination attempt. Breaking news meant stop what you're doing. Something extraordinary is happening. Now, things that by no reasonable construction of reality are important are tagged as breaking news. So what do they say to us when they actually have something that is worthy of our stopping? It's worthy of national attention. They no longer have the language to create attention-grabbing content for us.
Yeah.
So I worry about the constant need to draw our attention to things that are fundamentally trivial. Part of what news ought to be telling us is something important about something that matters when it matters.
Yeah, it's like when I glanced up and saw breaking news, I knew it probably wasn't going to be important. I mean, this is how I've been kind of conditioned
yes.
to the way cable news promotes this stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. And so now if something genuinely important happens, how do they signal you that it's
breaking,
important?
No, we're serious this time. Breaking
yeah.
news, right?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, I wanted to ask you about 2008 when President Obama, or then candidate Obama, said that he initially would accept presidential campaign funding. And then he backed out of that so he could raise and spend as much money as he wanted. And he ended up raising a lot of money. What if Obama and McCain had held to that? I mean, would that have made a kind of difference that would influence the campaigns that we're seeing today?
It was inevitable that someone was going to make the decision to break from the federal financing structure because someone would see an advantage in being able to raise much more money than that capped limit and would realize that the person had the capacity to do it. So had it not happened in 2008, it would have happened in 2012.
Hmm.
The problem is that money does create a net advantage if you have more than the other side under most circumstances. But what we found in studying the 2008 election, and we studied it carefully, we actually looked at all of the ads purchased
in every venue other than internet, and there wasn't much internet advertising that year. And we mapped those against a survey that looked day to day at the responses in the electorate, the attitudinal responses in the electorate. And what we found was that there was a point at which Obama hit diminishing returns. That is, he was substantially outspending McCain, but there was no longer an advantage out of the spending. So, you know, the net advantage does have a cap, but the capped advantage was far higher than it would have been. It wouldn't have hit that cap had they been under the federal financing limit. So Obama gained substantial advantage out of the fact that he broke from federal financing. In other words, tactically, he made a good decision. But to the extent that this drives candidates to spend much of their time raising money and increases the access of donors to power and minimizes the likelihood that candidates who don't want to engage in that kind of activity or don't have the means to self-finance stay out of the process, we rob ourselves of public servants who might do a really good job for us.
Did you say that you did the ad tracking in 2012 or 2008?
In 2008. And we were actually running a survey every single day during the election. And that's a year, remember, that Obama substantially outspends McCain.
That's right.
And so we're able to see what's the advantage in substantially outspending the other side. In net, when campaigns spend the same amount on both sides, the ads tend to cancel each other out. But when there's a disproportionate amount of money on one side, that side tends to gain advantage. Now, that could be an advantage simply in access. So you might be able to get it by getting speeches and getting comparable amount of access to the advertising on the other side. But in 2008, there was an advantage to Obama in breaking with federal financing because he gained a message advantage over McCain in the volume of his messaging in paid advertising.
We went back to an ad that I think was one of the real standout ads in the primary and caucus season in 2008. And it's interesting because Hillary Clinton's argument has changed quite a bit since then. But you know which ad I'm going to run. It's the 3 a.m. ad, and I'm curious about the impact of that. So let's listen.
It's 3 a.m., and your children are safe and asleep. But there's a phone in the White House, and it's ringing. Something's happening in the world. Your vote will decide who answers that call. Whether it's someone who already knows the world's leaders, knows the military, someone tested and ready to lead in a dangerous world.
Okay, I think we get the idea of this. This is interesting, Kathleen. I went back to read about this, and Mark Penn, who was Clinton's main strategist at the time, told Bloomberg News they only bought $500,000 worth of airtime, but there was so much discussion of it by journalists and cable news that it had a much deeper impression. How often does that happen?
It happens more often than we realize. One of the goals of advertisers is getting free airtime. And to the extent that the ad is evocative, interesting, and in particular if the ad is also funny, you increase the likelihood that it gets substantial amount of free play. Remember those famous Swift Boat Veterans for Truth so-called ads?
Oh, yes.
They gained their impact not by actual airing, but by being repeatedly aired at no cost to the campaign that was sponsoring them on cable news. We demonstrated that in the survey that we were running that year. There's a very small buy behind that. The same is true of the famous Daisy ad, by the way, in 1964.
It's the Goldwater one?
For a long time, provocative ad, free time, higher impact.
Richard on Twitter actually said, could you recap what happened when John Kerry was swift-boated very late in the campaign? What would you say to that, Kathleen?
The so-called Swift Boat Veterans for Truth ads gained large amounts of cable access, and during a period in which the Kerry campaign was not on the air at very high level in summer because he was saving his money for the end of the campaign. Remember, Al Gore ran out of money in the election before, and Kerry had learned that lesson. He'd overlearned that lesson. They didn't respond to those ads. They didn't take them seriously. They didn't think anybody was going to believe them. And over that summer period when those ads were airing, largely over a one-month period, that ad, coupled with some other circumstances, including a terrorist attack elsewhere and a Wall Street scare at the end of the Democratic convention, cost Kerry votes among moderate women and shifted the national security debate against Kerry.
Tom on Twitter says TiVo and ad blockers equals no ads. Wow, a lot of people finding their way to block out these ads. Steph on the page.
Rick wants to get the heart of all of it. He says, does advertising really change that many votes? I've never really been swayed from whom I was supporting based on voting. You never learn anything. The attacks against your candidates are easily shrugged off. The attacks for your opponent are just amplified. Seems like a big waste. Are they only looking for independent voters?
Yeah. Is that who it's targeted at, Kathleen, primarily?
It's targeted to voters who aren't already high partisans who've made up their minds about candidates. Once you've decided who your candidate is, or if you're strongly ideologically anchored in one party, the advertising isn't going to shift you to the other party. But there are a lot of people who are low-information voters. They're not paying a whole lot of attention. They have very busy lives, and they don't know much about one candidate, sometimes about both candidates. Advertising works best against or for a candidate about which we don't know very much, and with a voter who is not highly anchored in existing attitudes, because the person already knows that they're going to support one party or the other, one candidate or the other. Advertising doesn't shift votes of those who are highly anchored, know who they're going to vote for, and are locked into a party.
To Dan in Rosemont. Hi, Dan.
Yeah, how are you?
Doing good.
My concern listening to the discussion as I've been driving to work here is you're leaving one important person off the hook, and that's the voter.
Mm-hmm.
You're making excuses for us being so dumb that we can't sift through the wheat, separate the wheat from the chaff. If we're too lazy to actually get the information that isn't propagandized at us or sensationalized at us, that's our own problem. And it's too bad, but that we can't, you know, Spiro Agnew started the real blame the media bit back in the late 60s, you know, and it's just has taken hold and become this siren call that it's the media's fault. Well, we all know what the media is, so if it's our own doggone problem, we're not paying attention. You know, you can't blame the media, you can't blame attack ads. If we're dumb enough to listen to it, we deserve everything we get.
Well, Kathleen, I hear Dan, and yes, I'd like to have the media dodge some of this, but I also know that the advertising in often cases is true enough. Not completely true. It can be confusing.
And sometimes it's deliberately confusing.
Right.
But the caller is making an important point. What the new media environment has given us is a capacity, if we're motivated, to find good, accurate information and to determine where the candidates are trying to confuse us. Often, ambiguity is a rhetorical strategy for candidates. They want us to hear what we want to hear without actually explicitly saying it. And in a media environment in which you can go online and search through the best reporting in the country across the best media outlets and go to primary sources when you've got issues in contention, a voter who's motivated has more information than that person has ever had. The problem is most of us don't have time to do that.
Let's come back to this Empower Act that I mentioned. It's a bill in the Senate. It would increase the tax return checkoff to $20 per person. It would give candidates $6 for every $1 that they would bring in through small donors. Not the question of does it have a chance, but would it make a difference if it did?
I like anything that incentivizes small donations, because donating money to a candidate increases the likelihood that you're committed to the candidate, that you'll talk about the candidate, that you'll work for the candidate. We need to find ways to increase the likelihood that elections translate into our personal lives about matters that we care about and that we communicate that to our family, friends, and within our neighborhoods. Now, that said, I don't think we should let the media off the hook when we ask what the money is being spent for. It's largely media.
Right.
There's no reason when the airwaves are publicly owned that the media should not be providing more open, unpaid access for candidates in some systematic fashion. The amount of money that is paid in advertising through media channels ensures the profitability of stations around the country and battleground states throughout the country. They need to give back in the form of more free access to candidates.
So tell me what that looks like.
We have this in other countries in which, you know, depending on the previous vote, a certain amount of open airtime is provided for the candidates to say anything they would like to the electorate. I'd like to see that happening. We this year are seeing candidate speeches attracting a reasonable amount of attention on television and cable. What would happen if the networks were to say that the candidates are going to be given a half hour every Sunday night split between the two of them, 15-15, provided they sit down in the studio and deliver a speech to the nation on a topic that's preset every week for 6 weeks? Could we get the electorate to come to watch? Could we get the networks to give the time? Would we increase the likelihood that they would engage substantively on the issues by doing it? I think the answer is worth exploring. I think the answer may be yes.
But you know, I see, I mean, right now, CNN, and presumably because you were looking at MSNBC, they're taking Trump's speech live. Now, yes, it's in the middle of the day, but they're kind of doing what you've just described, aren't they?
But it's the middle of the day,
yes,
when most people are working. I mean, the time that we really need to think about politics, I like a proposal that was made by my colleagues at Harvard a number of years ago. They called it something like the six Sundays or the seven Sundays. It was, let's reserve a little part of our lives during the general election to hearing the candidates talk directly to camera to us about consequential issues, issue by issue, week to week, in a civil fashion. Let's incentivize that. We should be able, as a country, to say we're going to devote a half hour a week for 6 to 8 weeks to listening to these people and then holding them accountable, then letting media perform a different function reportorially by asking how accurate was it, what did we learn, not tactically what did they gain from it, and how many voters are they likely to get as a result. We need to change the way we campaign to focus more on the substantive similarities and differences that will actually forecast governance and less on the mindless name-calling and the pointless pandering that doesn't actually tell us what they're going to do or how we're going to solve the nation's problems.
That is an exciting idea. And so the speeches would have to be policy. They could not be the kind of speech that I see Donald Trump is giving right now, in which he's saying Clinton is a world-class liar. I mean, they would really have to be about policy.
I mean, suppose you said, you know, night one, what will you do with the economy? What will you do about the economy?
Right.
You take the issues the public says it cares about when you ask open-ended questions in polls. If a candidate devoted his or her 15 minutes to distraction and name-calling, that candidate would be, you know, saying something very important to the American people about the kind of person the candidate would be as president. We would be incentivizing the candidates to offer the serious substantive differences and similarities. So you wouldn't be able to mandate that they say anything, but rather you'd be creating a structure in which if they didn't treat it seriously, they would be failing the audition for president.
Yeah. One brief note here. You know, I used to think the Europeans, because the campaigns are shorter, right, and they seem more civil, but I mm-hmm. know you've been following the rhetoric in the Brexit campaign. It sounds a lot like an American election, the way this Brexit campaign went.
We've exported our American political consulting system around the world. It's one export I wish we had much, much less of.
Kathleen, always grateful for the time. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Kathleen Hall Jamieson is director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm.